Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Security agency wants to create a database of every telephone call ever made in the U.S. And to do that, the spy agency has been secretly collecting the phone call records of millions of Americans. This is according to anonymous sources quoted in a report in today's USA Today. It comes at a time when the NSA is already under fire for warrantless wiretaps of international communications made by Americans suspected of ties to terrorists. It also comes as former NSA chief, General Michael Hayden, is trying to confirmation as director of the CIA. Today, the President Bush defended the program.
First, our intelligence activities strictly target Al-Qaeda and their known affiliates. Al-Qaeda is our enemy, and we want to know their plans. Second, the government does not listen to domestic phone calls without court approval. Third, the intelligence activities I authorized are lawful and have been briefed to appropriate members of Congress, both Republican and Democrat. Fourth, the privacy of ordinary Americans is fiercely protected in all our activities. We're not mining or trolling through the personal lives of millions of innocent Americans.
Well, the president denies the report of mining, but the news today prompted senators on both sides of the aisle to express their concern. California Senator Dianne Feinstein said the nomination of General Hayden could now be in jeopardy. Well, joining us on the line is John Diamond. He covers security and intelligence issues for USA Today. He was a part of today's report. And John, first of all, your response to what the president said. He spoke for only about 2 minutes, and obviously in response to the USA Today report. Your thoughts?
I think a key point to keep in mind is that the president says that the government does not listen to domestic calls without court approval. That is not a contradiction of our story. Our story does not say that this program involves listening. It's very important for your listeners to understand that the USA Today story says that this is data collection, in other words, the records of calls, what number was called, from what number, at what time, that sort of thing, not the transcript or tape recording of the call itself.
Without names or content of the call.
The names could be gotten because, of course, you can track back starting with a phone number and get to the name. But the content of the calls would be lost unless it was a call specifically being targeted. Now, we know the president is saying that no domestic calls are dropped upon without court approval. So that was a flat statement there by the president.
Well, now, what do you mean by that? And I suppose as part of this, we should explain the difference between this surveillance or mining, as some people are calling it, that you're reporting about today, and the warrantless wiretapping that has been reported on already. What is the same and what is different about the two programs?
What's the same is they're both run by the NSA. They both were authorized by the president shortly after 9/11, and they're both geared toward finding terrorists and preventing terrorist attacks. However, the warrantless surveillance program, we're told, and this has been said publicly many times, is carefully targeted. The data collection that we're talking about is blanket. It's universal. It's collecting all the phone record data. The warrantless surveillance program focuses on communications that are believed linked to terrorism. Obviously, if you're collecting records of all phone calls, you're getting all sorts of phone calls that have nothing whatever to do with terrorism. Mm-hmm. And the warrantless program involved international communications, both emails and phone calls. And the data being collected that we're describing in our story includes domestic phone calls, strictly domestic.
Well, now, and the president's reaction, as we just heard, is that he claims that the federal government is not mining, but according to your report, and he did say, as you said, we should underscore this, that the federal government is not listening in on domestic calls, and you agree, according to your report, that's not what's happening. But as to the mining, AT&T, Verizon, and Bell South say they are providing this information. They've told you they're doing it under the law. One phone company, though, denied the NSA requests for this kind of information. That was Quest. Why?
That's right. There were concerns on the part of Quest about their own legal exposure if they were to go along with this. There have already been lawsuits even before our story ran. Some of the phone companies have been sued for helping out the NSA on its various surveillance programs. So there was clearly some legal concern. There might have been moral qualms as well. I can't testify to that, but that potentially is part of it. What the president said, he said, we're not mining or trolling through the personal lives of millions of Americans. I don't necessarily see that as an absolute denial that any kind of data mining is going on. Our understanding of the way this program works is that they are looking, using computer techniques and data mining techniques, to look for patterns, to look for flurries of phone calling activity, perhaps focused on some phone numbers that they are aware of. They start perhaps with a phone number of a known suspect, a terror suspect perhaps, or ally of some sort. They work their way out in sort of concentric circles to other phone numbers, people that are in touch with that individual, and they move out from there.
Well, perhaps the president is making the difference between the word mining and the word collecting, but we've seen other reports. You mentioned the lawsuit. A civil liberties group has sued AT&T to find out more about this, and as part of that lawsuit, a technician has come forward, and others have apparently as well, to say, I installed the equipment.
Right, that's right. When you consider the number of phone calls made in the United States every day, and you consider that the NSA has collected a database of virtually all of them, with the exception of those provided by Quest, we're talking gigantic numbers here. There's no way to usefully access information in that database without data mining techniques. That's the only way you can wrestle with something this large. So it's clear that those sorts of techniques are being used.
And John Diamond, one last question. How is this playing out in the confirmation hearings of CIA nominee, former NSA head, General Michael Hayden?
Right. General Hayden, of course, would have been the guy in charge at NSA when this program began shortly after 9/11. He's up next week for a confirmation hearing to be the CIA director. Senator Dianne Feinstein already has said that nomination may be in jeopardy. And she's someone who's praised General Hayden in the past. General Hayden is somebody who has strong support on Capitol Hill. He's a very engaging and an intelligent individual who's spent a lot of time up there briefing members. But clearly the nomination has problems already because he's a uniformed officer, and there are senators who feel that right now is not the right time to put a general officer in charge of the CIA at a time when there are turf battles between that agency and the Pentagon over foreign intelligence. Now, on top of that, you have this story and raising questions about whether General Hayden was fully forthcoming in the way he described what the NSA was up to in the months since the original surveillance story broke last December.
John Diamond, he covers national security and intelligence issues for USA Today, which is reporting today about a new a database being put together by the NSA that would compile all Americans' domestic phone records. John Diamond, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Well, the rhetoric is heating up between the U.S. and Russia. What does that mean for relations between the two countries? This week, during his State of the Nation address, Russian President Vladimir Putin invoked a fairy tale. He said, as they say, Comrade Wolf knows whom to swallow. Putin went on to say, he swallows without listening to anyone, nor does he intend to listen to anyone, judging by all appearances. Putin seemed to be responding to Vice President Dick Cheney, who recently criticized Russia for backpedaling on democratic reforms. All this comes as Russia's influence is growing, in thanks in large part to a monopoly on natural gas reserves, on which the former Soviet republics and much of Europe depend. But at the same time, Russia's population is shrinking. Marshall Goldman of Harvard University's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies joins us now in the studio with a look at what seems to be a country in transition. Would you say that, Marshall?
It certainly is. It's beginning to flex its muscles. And what Putin had to say the other day simply is a reflection of that. It's really quite amazing.
Well, could we talk about one of the points that Putin really seemed to dwell on, one of Russia's problems? There was an interesting moment when he was giving the speech in which he seemed to be stumbling, trying to get to the point of this shrinking population. He said, what we need, and someone shouted out,
love.
What is going on with the population there?
Well, what was interesting, apparently the person who shouted that was the Minister of Defense, Sergei Ivanov. What's happening is that Russia's population is shrinking on an average of 700,000 a year.
A year?
Yes. So this is no small amount. And in other words, in 2005, the population was 143 million. That's down from almost 150 million in 1992.
Why? Is that just because of people not having families?
Well,
what are the other?
That's part of the birth rate is very low. The death rate far exceeds the birth rate. People are simply not getting married or they're not having children. And this began sharply. If you look at a population tree, it begins sharply in 1990 when the reforms, Soviet Union collapse and the new reforms begin. But also, life expectancy is very low. It's embarrassing, but life expectancy for males in Russia is about 58 and a half years. That's, you know, most of us would be dead already.
And we understand people are emigrating from Russia to the
That also does not, that does not help. They're leaving, but the main thing is really the death rate. It's from poor diets. It's from mainly from alcoholism. It's partly the AIDS epidemic. It's just everything is going wrong.
So given that there are these domestic problems, you know, one wonders why Putin felt the strength to flex some muscle towards the U.S. It would seem, you know, that with so many domestic problems, this would not be the right time. But you say there's another issue.
Well, it's not only the fact that the population is shrinking, which has impact on the army, it has impact on manufacturing. And of course, they've got problems still in Chechnya. But their strength comes from the fact that they suddenly now are earning billions of dollars a year by selling natural gas and oil to the rest of the world, particularly Western Europe. Germany, for example, gets over 40% of its natural gas from Russia. And it's tied to the pipeline. And that means that if you cut off that pipeline, the Germans, as they discovered this past January, get cold.
And how has this, you know, transpired? How is it that it would seem to many of us suddenly it has this strength of these, natural gas and oil?
Well, the pipeline has been there for years, obviously. They didn't get 40% overnight. But what happened is the oil prices went up and energy prices generally, including gas, went up. Then it captures our attention and it captures Russia's attention. One way to measure this is to look at the size of the reserves, foreign currency and gold that Russia has. 8 years ago, they defaulted. They closed the banks. They defaulted on their debt. They only had a few billion dollars in the treasury, and they just simply refused to pay $20 billion. Today, Russia has the third largest amount of gold and currency reserves, only second to China and Japan. That's just an incredible transformation, and that reflects the earnings from this oil and gas export.
Marshall Goldman, as you write in a paper that's about to be published, Russia's transformation from impoverished supplicant to haughty creditor has been breathtaking. And in the minute we have in this segment, we're going to continue this conversation. How much of that has to do with Russia nationalizing?
Well, it's they're retaking the control of some of these oil companies, some of the gas companies, and Putin is putting some of his buddies from the KGB in charge of them, and they've got the strength and they're flaunting it, and they're telling the Europeans that if you give us a hard time, we'll just cut off the flow, and that has already happened. We've seen.
Well, everyone was looking at the Middle East.
That's right.
Suddenly, a threat from another direction. Marshall Goldman, associate director of Harvard University's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies. When we come back, what does this mean for U.S.-Russian relations? Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Of Harvard University's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies about, well, Russia's new muscle. Russia now the world's largest exporter of natural gas, the second largest exporter of petroleum. First of all, Marshall, do you think that Russia is positioning itself to become a superpower once again?
Without doubt. First of all, the emphasis on power already with the energy. They already have the power. But in terms of military activity, this is clearly what Putin intends to do. And he understands he's got to do it in a very careful way. His first priority is to build up the economy. He's posited a goal of doubling the economy in 10 years' time, and he's going to fall a little short of that, but he's moved in that direction. And then he's talking about avoiding an arms race because he recognizes, that's what he said yesterday, he can't win that. But he said if we are smart, if we aren't, and use our intellectual abilities, we can develop new technologies which will boost us up that way. Right now, Russia's military budget is only 4% of ours, and he knows he can't match us.
Well, as he said in his speech this week, in reference to the U.S., their house is their fortress, good for them, but that means that we also must make our house strong and reliable.
Absolutely. He sees this. He understands this. And he went on to say, of course, is that we're going to move in that direction because we have to be strong in other so that they won't push us around.
Well, you know, Marshall, some might say, what's wrong with that? Who wants a failing Russia? Who wants a Russia that isn't strong to maybe be an ally of the U.S.?
Well, no, I think that's a good point. Although whether they're going to be an ally we were allies certainly in Afghanistan, and there's some still continuing exchange of intelligence for information about terrorism. But our interests, and as we see in this case, diverge. What we're concerned about is we don't want Russia to be so strong that it can blackmail, as it's just been doing, Western Europe, because we count on Western Europe as a more important ally.
Right. And you have met with Vladimir Putin, and you just were telling me during the break you're going to meet with him again in September.
That's right.
Well, some have faulted President Bush for thinking that they had a friendship. What did he say? He looked into Putin's soul. What do you think? Do you think Putin was once closer to Bush and now is flexing muscle, or do you think it was never true?
I think actually it was true. It's bizarre. I mean, that these two very different individuals, Putin, who was an agent for the KGB, Bush, who's very strong Democrat, or no, strong American Republican, but a nationalist, that the two of them should really bond this way. I've met with Putin twice before. In both instances, he made unsolicited references to George Bush, George W. Bush, that were very flattering. He said it before the election, and then he said it that he would vote for Bush if he had a chance, which was just an astonishing thing. I think our relations would be much worse if they didn't have this bonding, because both constituencies, the American constituency is pushing Bush away from Russia, and Putin's constituency is becoming very anti-American and pushing Putin, but they still have this closeness.
Well, Putin seemed to play to that this week, perhaps, when he said things like he questioned and mocked America's moral authority, said that the U.S. puts its political interests above democratic ideals. I'm paraphrasing. He basically seem to be calling the Bush administration hypocrites, noting that while Vice President Dick Cheney, as we said, was criticizing Russia, he was meeting with the presidents of countries like Kazakhstan that are ruled by autocrats with human rights issues.
He's got a good point. That's exactly – there was an enormous amount of hypocrisy. And, Dick Cheney, of all people, saying that that the Russians are not observing human rights, they're abusing this, and they're increasing the role of the secret police, particularly on a day when it's just announced that the United States has our security forces have introduced this whole idea of listening to everybody or making record of everybody's phone calls. I mean, it gets hard to distinguish what is the United States, what's Russia.
And what does this mean for the need the U.S. might have for Russia to help out with Iran, for instance?
This is in jeopardy. The Russians have been hesitant to push Iran too far, although they are, after all, Iran's neighbor, and to the extent that Iran has missiles that can fire what may be nuclear weapons, it's going to be Russia that's going to be more affected than the United States. But this does not push for more cooperation on the part of the Russians. I mean, after all, you have to realize that Putin has his people who are saying, don't do what the United States has, and this is reflected in his speech. Just as Bush very often caters in his speeches to the far right, so Putin has to cater to his far right.
I'm talking to Marshall Goldman, who knows a thing or two about Russia. You, in this paper that's about to be published, you mention an Arabic proverb that Russian President Vladimir Putin recently used. He was responding to the possibility that the U.S. might try to kick Russia out of the G8, which is coming up. And he said, "The dog barks, but the caravan moves on." What did he mean by that?
Well, coming from the Middle East, from Saudi Arabia, that's where the proverb comes from. It means that the dog, in this case, it's Senator McCain and Congressman Lantos, who both have been calling for the United States not to participate in the G8. They're barking.
Because Russia...
Russia's chairing it. Russia's just been admitted to it. It'll be hosting it in St. Petersburg in July. And it's a sign, it's supposed to be, the G8 is supposed to be the eight largest democratic countries. And they're saying Russia is no longer qualified for that because it's not democratic.
Because, and just to remind us, because
they're cracking down on it at war in Chechnya. They're cracking down on NGOs. They're making it difficult for democratic parties. They're surveilling conversations. They've just really turned their back on so many democratic reforms that they'd made earlier. And so the dogs are barking.
McCain and others.
McCain and Lantos. But we're moving on, and we're moving on. If you don't like it, that's just tough because we're going to do it because we've got the oil, we've got the gas, and we're going to be strong, and you're just going to have to take it.
Right. And on that note, how do you think the U.S. should respond to that?
Well, I don't fault Cheney for going to try to provide an alternate pipeline. That's what he was doing when he was in Kazakhstan, although to talk about human rights is not such a good thing to do there. What he's trying to do is to convince them to build a gas pipeline through the Caspian Sea, which will then provide for the Central Asians to take their natural gas out to Western Europe, and that'll break up Russia's monopoly.
So you're saying that the U.S. Should in fact be thinking about protecting itself from its good ally, Russia.
It's new, the regaining superpower.
Yeah. Dr. Marshall Goldman of Harvard University's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies, talking to us about the emergence of Russia as the world's next, again, superpower. Marshall, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
And stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where
the price of fuel is already having a big impact on summer airline travel. Also, if you think you're going to use up some of those frequent flyer miles this summer, you may be out of luck. To find out more about the summer travel season, we turn to travel writer Khalil Sakakini from, among other places, the website gotravelupdates.com. And Khalil, what's going on? What's the supply and demand equation in the airline industry right now?
Well, if we had forever, we might be able to make a dent in the question. But the problem is the complete lack of airline transparency. I mean, the joke is you can be in an airplane and no two people have ever paid the same price. And some math wizard with too much time in his hands calculated that there are probably about 1,000 different fares for any one particular given destination. So it's just incredibly complex.
Well, we understand that they're all going up, that, you know, the prices are rising and that there are going to be fewer seats available on a shrinking number of planes, so that the seats in planes are being reduced while the ticket prices are going up.
Well, that's true. But, you know, it's not as arbitrary as it seems, because this whole thing is a function of what they call, and I don't want to get technical, but yield management, which originated in the U.S. after deregulation. There's a robotic system called the GDS, Global Distribution System. And what that does just simply mechanically and automatically finds where the airlines can make the most profit. And that often shows that they have to reduce these flights, reduce these number of seats in order to maximize their profits or optimize their profits.
Right.
So it's certainly a function they punch in fuel costs and everything else.
Well, and take advantage of the fact that apparently more and more people want to fly. We're reading in today's Boston Globe here in the Boston area that four out of every five seats were filled with paying passengers in April, and industry officials expect that this is going to continue through the summer. People want to fly more than they ever had, almost as much as pre-9/11. In fact, the Globe says the last time the industry's load factor topped 80% was in 1945.
Right.
So it seems as if the airlines are scrambling to take advantage of the fact that more people want to fly.
Well, there's no question. I mean, travel, interestingly, Robert, it's not a commodity. I mean, people think of it just as a price-sensitive thing. But in many ways, it's part fantasy, so that, you know, people attach a lot of emotions and a lot of feeling to travel and to their vacation. When you work 50 weeks a year, you get 2 weeks off. You want the flight presumably to be an experience. So there's a lot of fantasy involved, and the airlines are noticing that people are flying more, but the fuel costs are increasing considerably, so they're squeezed. So their mechanical systems say, look, let's reduce the number of flights, reduce the number of seats, Let's line up the supply and the demand.
Yeah. Is this happening across the board or just with the airlines that are in trouble?
Oh, I think it's happening across the board, but I think you can't rely on it because if fuel prices drop or if you're a clever shopper, you may find that you slip under the radar of these increases and shifts and fluxes. But I think just because there are fewer planes and maybe fewer seats flying, that doesn't necessarily mean that more passengers will be unable to fly. It just simply means the airlines are moving to a more efficient system.
Well, and some are saying that. Some are applauding the fact that the airlines are getting more efficient. I think the phrase that's used is they're disciplining themselves. But, you know, talking about getting seats, we understand as well that if you think you're going to use some of your frequent flyer miles this summer, you might be in trouble because the airlines are reducing the number of seats that they will give away to frequent flyers.
Yeah, they're doing that. And also, of course, there's the onerous, vexing blackout where you can't fly for these days, can't fly for these days. But I think personally that because of the existence of low-cost, I guess I want to call them low-cost airlines like JetBlue, it becomes almost irrelevant, the frequent flyer mile, because you can get a better deal with less hassle on, let's say, JetBlue than you could by pulling your hair out trying to deal with American Airlines and booking a flight for two or three people when you have to deal with blackout dates and limited number of frequent flyer seats.
Well, and you also might want to look overseas. We understand airlines are, although they're reducing the number of flights in the U.S. and reducing seats on flights in the U.S., they're adding seats on international flights because they're more lucrative.
They are more lucrative, and that's simply where a lot of energy, more people in the U.S. travel than any other country, obviously, because it's bigger, and people are, for them, travel is a necessity more than a luxury. And sure, they're adding more seats because that's where they make their profit. And they're doing a good job, but I think people make the mistake in thinking the airlines have a reason to offer the cheapest seat or cheapest ticket, and they really don't. They're under no obligation whatsoever. So often when they'll say this is the lowest possible fare, they mean the lowest published fare, but our listeners should know there are ways of getting a fare lower than the, quote, published fare.
And, by the way, you're talking about going online and finding people such as yourself?
Well, you know what? If you booked a flight online and you did it after midnight, you would watch the whole computer reconfigure itself. So the chances of getting a cheaper flight when the computer reconfigures is better after midnight, and then again, it's like a point to 3:37 in the morning where the computer reconfigures again. So it really is a game of just having a lot of patience, but also being smart and knowing where to go.
Well, we have some numbers here. For instance, the Globe reports that the lowest round-trip fare from Boston to L.A. in mid-June, coming up on the travel website Orbitz.com,
right,
is $375. But last year, in May, it was $309. So that's a big increase.
It is. And I guess what I would probably end up saying again is if you were to do the research today, obviously that price would change still. So yes, it is higher. But yes, I guess the key thing is the crazy fluctuation of the prices. Obviously, they're trending higher. But then again, it depends upon what time of day you look and where you look and how you look. But yeah, the trend is certainly higher.
Do you think overall, Khalil, that that's the way it's got to go? I mean, people have been telling us that, here on Here and Now, that, you know, the price of gas is going to go up. Europeans pay more. Do you think that there's a sense that we had a lovely time? We all had, everyone could fly and the prices were pretty darn good, but it's not realistic and they're going to stay up.
Well, they will stay up. Whether they'll stay this high or not, I don't know, but they certainly will stay up. But the price of fuel, obviously, is one factor that's driving the airlines' pricing. They're also pricing seats differently. So you may now have to pay an a la carte price. You'll have to pay for one price for an aisle seat, one price for a window seat, and you never know, one price for the dreaded center seat.
Are there any other trends you'd like to point out to us that we may see in the future?
What bothers me really deeply is, again, the lack of airline transparency. There's a rule. That's why the FTC gets more complaints about travel than any other industry, because it's so complex and, again, so full of fantasy. But there's a trend now for the airlines to want to be able to advertise their prices, but not the complete price. They don't want to have to fold in or even reference the cost of taxes or departure taxes or fuel surcharges or whatever. So they are asking now that they can post a price without necessarily having it to reflect or reveal the true price. Mm. And that really bothers me, because we should be moving toward transparency and simplicity instead of complexity and shell games.
Khalil Sakakini, he's a travel writer for GoTravelUpdates.com. By the way, you can link to it at our website, here-now.org. And Khalil, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome, Robert.
And still to come today, author Augustine Burroughs of Running with Scissors fame. He'd like to move to fiction, but he just can't stop writing about himself. You're listening to Here and Now. I think that I shall never see a poem as lovely as a tree. It still works for me, that first line of Trees by Joyce Kilmer. Kilmer is an alumnus of Columbia University, and each year Columbia holds a bad poetry contest in Kilmer's memory. Hey, is Trees a bad poem? Producer Sarah Elzis explores that question.
In deep thought, I return from the laundromat of my soul, where I pick up the blazer of my spirit, and the khakis of my heart, and the Afghan of despair. I realize I hardly knew my soul at all, and he is Korean.
That was Josh Schwartz reading his poem, Deep Thoughts on Laundry. He was reading at a bad poetry contest held by the Philolexian Society at Columbia University in New York. This bad poetry competition is held every year in memory of a Columbia alum, Joyce Kilmer. Kilmer's most widely known poem is Trees. It's recited at Arbor Day celebrations. It's been set to music several times. And it's even been referenced in movies, like Superman 2.
Kryptonian Memory Bank. Education Crystal number 308.
Trees. By Joyce Kilmer of the planet Earth.
What?
I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree. A tree whose hungry...
He's not here. It's a voice from the past. That's cute. That's very
breast.
Cute. Very cute.
A tree that looks at God all day.
I like trees.
So does your average Cocker Spaniel.
I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree.
A tree whose hungry mouth is pressed against the earth's sweet flowing breast. I'm Tom Vinciguerra. I am the avatar of the Philolexian Society at Columbia. I wonder if Trees would win the Kilmer Bad Poetry Contest today. I tend to think not, because I think that it was sincere. A tree that looks at God all day and lifts her leafy arms to pray. A tree that may in summer wear
a tree that may in summer wear a nest of robins in her hair, upon whose bosom snow has lain, who intimately lives with rain. I'm Rachel Haddis, a poet and professor of English at the Newark campus of Rutgers University. My take on the poem is it's rather slight. It is free of irony and self-consciousness, except that little reference to fools like me at the end, which I find kind of charming.
Poems are made by fools like me. But only God can make a tree. My name is Hugh Kilmer. I'm the oldest grandson of Joyce Kilmer. I do like it. I like others better.
Trees is a short little poem about a tree with that nice image about the mouth is pressed against the earth's sweet flowing breast.
Yes, sweet flowing.
In a sense, this is a very romantic poem. The tree is personified and full of emotion. So just because the year 1900 had come and gone, it's wrong to think that romanticism had died.
Trees, of course, have been set to music several different times.
Boys, are you ready for Trees?
Yes!
Ladies and gentlemen, here it is.
The one that's most famous is the Oscar Rosbach Trees. Ba, 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 ba.
It has been translated into something like a dozen languages, and it has been sung by many people, including Alfalfa of the Little Rascals.
I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree.
There are 13 service areas on the New Jersey Turnpike, and the Joyce Kilmer service area is one of them.
The best memorial for poets is, in Robert Frost's words, to lodge some poems where they're hard to get rid of. It's like a splinter under your fingernail. It's not utterly comfortable, but it's there. If that's what a good poet does, Kilmer has lodged that poem. He hit the jackpot.
Only God can lie, God
can. But what does Kilmer think about a rest stop with toilets named after him? Stay with us more ahead here and now. That piece from Sarah Elsis. Writes about himself. His smash best-selling memoir, Running with Scissors, told of a painful, bizarre, often hilarious upbringing in which he says he was adopted by his mother's controversial psychiatrist who kept a pedophile in the backyard shed and his family in squalor. Well, Burroughs' story was both a bestseller and the subject of a lawsuit from the real psychiatrist's family. His new essay collection, his second, is called Possible Side Effects. His publisher removed the subtitle True Stories in the wake of the Running with Scissors lawsuit, and Augustine adds in an author's note that many of the characters are composites. But he also says in one essay, the truth is it's still all about him because he just can't get away from it. Wherever I go in the world, he writes, Augustine followed. Sure, I would go to Europe like everyone else, but I'd leave behind a debris field, empty wrappers, stained pillows, and a trail of blood. And Augustine Burroughs joins us in the studio now. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, it's very nice to speak with you. And I read that line and I thought, a trail of blood. Now, I'm wondering if you mean figuratively, and we're going to talk about that in a moment, but you do mean literally. You have this problem that, you know, some people have where your fingers split. And
they do, no matter spring, summer, winter, fall, you know, no matter what moisturizer I use, ever since I was a kid.
But, you know, you say at one point in the book, maybe, and this was in the voice of the young Augustine Burroughs, who has to go to a dermatologist, but at one point, I think it was in that essay, you said, what is this? Is it maybe something in me that is just so toxic that it's bleeding out? I'm sort of paraphrasing.
Yeah, no, that's what it felt like. It felt like this is sort of the outward manifestation of something flawed or gaping or cut within me. It feels to me, and it still does to this day, like this is damage. I'm relatively normal and together despite what I went through as a child, and yet my fingers remain cut. You know, so it's like there's a part of me that literally and figuratively will never heal.
Right. And you write about many things in this book, and we'll touch on them, but you do write about that childhood. The last essay in particular, Julia's Child, it's about, you know, your alcoholic dad who never got up on his days off and your mom who had mental illness and the fact that you pretty much were raised by Julia Child on TV watching her cook. That would seem to be, you know, that part of you still that's not healed.
Yeah, that is the part that's not healed. So I did find comfort watching Julia Child because there was something very soothing to the steps and to her voice and her utter mastery. You know, she could do these complicated, impossible souffles, and there was a process, you know. So I would then get up and imitate it. I would have my own little cooking show in the kitchen, talking to the window, pretending it was a camera, you know, making a mess.
Yelling, and cut, when
cut,
was it going
you know,
up?
And it felt really real to me. I mean, I really felt like I was replicating what I'd seen. And I'm still, to this day, when I am anxious, I will watch the DVD of the original series.
Huh. Well, and this was before your mother, who again had mental illness, as you write in Running with Scissors, sent you to live with her psychiatrist's family. Now, I know that there's a lawsuit pending. The family of the psychiatrist has said that you grossly misinterpreted them in your book, but also made them recognizable. And I know that you cannot talk about that lawsuit because it's pending. But it brings me to, you know, another part of that essay about your mom, which is that she gave you a recorder.
A little tape recorder, yeah.
And you started telling stories into the tape recorder.
Right.
And you have this exchange at the end of that essay. She asks you what you're telling stories about. And you say, well, I talk about you and my father. And she says, oh, well, don't say anything hateful about me. Don't worry, I said, smiling. I would never do that. That's the end of the book.
That's the end of the book.
Well, what would you say to most readers who would say, what? They would interpret a lot of what you've said as being hate that you have towards these people, mother, psychiatrist, whoever they are?
You know, actually, I don't. I didn't hate my mother. That period of my life, I worshipped my mother, and it was inconceivable to me that I would ever feel differently. Mm. I don't feel that I've said anything mean to be mean. I never wrote any of my books, you know, certainly not Running with Scissors, and any of them, none of them were written out of spite.
But it made...
it caused incredible damage.
And in telling those stories, I guess that gets to that line, you leave a trail of blood.
When you tell the truth, it upsets people. Many people do not like to look at the truth. They do not like the truth. They don't like to be confronted with the mirror. And it causes turbulence, and it's unavoidable, you know, if you're going to be a memoirist.
Of course, you can pay me a nickel for this, but some people would say that if you tell all the stories that maybe, you know, although you've left a figurative trail of blood, your fingers might stop bleeding. You
yeah.
know, you
right.
yourself might stop bleeding.
Right.
You can pay me later. but it's not all about, you know, telling what happened as a child. It's about falling in love as an adult with a dog. You and your partner, Dennis, had a dog, Bentley, and then you decided he needed a friend. You got an adorable little puppy who wasn't lovable at first.
No, he was not lovable. He was, you know, adorable in the pet store, and then as soon as we got him home, he was barking nonstop and misbehaving. And I really had a feeling that this is the worst impulse purchase of my life. This was a mistake. It was like, sort of like a postpartum depression. Someone had said that to me, and I thought that's exactly what it was. You know, I was grieving because there was nothing we could do. We were stuck with this dog. And there came to that came to pass, you know. We both became profound. You know, myself, Dennis, Bentley, the three of us became profoundly attached to this other fourth member of the family, Cow, the Cow.
Well, in fact, why don't you read us the point where you suddenly realize that something has happened?
If I had to choose, I could not. Cow is my left arm, Bentley, my right. They both sit on my lap in the morning while I read email. Dennis cooks them hamburgers sometimes. We feed them ice cubes, and after they melt on the floor, both dogs bark at the wetness that remains. They slap at the spots with their front paws as if to say, "Get up! Be ice again!" Bentley is graceful like a seal. Cow is low-slung and close to the ground. When he walks, he shifts from side to side like a bouncer at a nightclub whose shoulder muscles are too huge. I do not recall a specific day when I began loving the cow. Dennis doesn't either. It's interesting because we were so aware of our original lack of affection for him that it seems remarkable to have come from there to here, from a place where we wanted to return him like a pair of defective shoes, to a place where we crave him like water.
Augustine Burroughs, writing and talking about his dog Cow Cow, and about just about everything else. You know how when you get angry at motorists, you might hold up pornographic pictures to get
if they change lanes, you know, right, incorrectly, or don't use their blinker, you might get a little revenge.
Is there a point at which you say, okay, enough about me and my dog and my mom, and, you know, is there a point where it will be mined?
Yeah, this is probably my last essay collection. I'm going to write a memoir, another memoir about my relationship with my father. That was such a difficult relationship, and it was so complex. It could never, ever have been shoehorned into a book, because it would have taken over the book. And then I love to return to fiction. I love the freedom. When I write memoir, I know the ending of the story before I sit down. You know, I know everything that's going to happen.
Well, Augustine Burroughs, I'm just wondering, how many more relatives do you have?
I have so many.
And are they hiding? Or are they like, oh my gosh?
I could tell you, you know, I could write memoirs for the rest of my life. I haven't even begun to go down the Ledford side of the family. I probably have five more essay collections fully ready at home. I don't know that I'll ever release, you know, more of it, but it's there. It's absolutely there.
Author Augustine Burroughs, his latest essay collection, Possible Side Effects. Augustine, thanks so much for speaking with us. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our thanks today to PRX and producer Sarah Elzis for our story about Joyce Kilmer's lovely poem, Trees. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories.